So the reading today is 1 Kings 21. I'm going to read verse 1 to 22 and then verse 27. Sometime later, there was an incident involving a vineyard belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. The vineyard was in Jezreel, close to the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. Ahab said to Naboth, "Let me have your vineyard to use for a vegetable garden, since it is close to my palace. In exchange, I will give you a better vineyard, or if you prefer, I will pay you whatever it is worth." But Naboth replied, "The Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers." So Ahab went home sullen and angry, because Naboth the Jezreelite had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." He lay on his bed sulking and refused to eat. His wife Jezebel came in and asked him, "Why are you so sullen? Why won't you eat?" He answered her, "Because I said to Naboth the Jezreelite, 'Sell me your vineyard, or if you prefer, I will give you another vineyard in its place.' But he said, 'I will not give you my vineyard.'" Jezebel, his wife, said, "Is this how you act as king over Israel? Get up and eat. Cheer up. I'll get you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name, placed his seal on them, and sent them to the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city with him. In those letters she wrote, "Proclaim a day of fasting and seat Naboth in a prominent place among the people, but seat two scoundrels opposite him and have them testify that he has cursed both God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death." So the elders and nobles who lived in Naboth's city did as Jezebel directed in the letter she had written to them. They proclaimed a fast and seated Naboth in a prominent place among the people. Then two scoundrels came and sat opposite him and brought charges against Naboth before the people, saying, "Naboth has cursed both God and the king." So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death. Then they sent word to Jezebel, "Naboth has been stoned and is dead." As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned to death, she said to Ahab, "Get up and take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite that he refused to sell you. He is no longer alive, but dead." When Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, he got up and went down to take possession of Naboth's vineyard. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, "Go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He is now in Naboth's vineyard, where he has gone to take possession of it. Say to him, 'This is what the Lord says. Have you not murdered a man and seized his property?' Then say to him, 'This is what the Lord says. In the place where dogs licked up Naboth's blood, dogs will lick up your blood. Yes, yours.'" Ahab said to Elijah, "So you have found me, my enemy." "I have found you," he answered, "because you have sold yourself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord. I'm going to bring disaster on you. I will consume your descendants and cut off from Ahab every last male in Israel, slave or free. I will make your house like that of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and that of Baasha, son of Ahijah, because you have provoked me to anger and caused Israel to sin." When Ahab heard these words, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and fasted. He lay in sackcloth and went around meekly.
Okay, especially good morning to Ultra Crew. Thank you for staying down. I've called this morning, "It's So Much More Than Grapes." So much more. Thank you so much for the first part where you put Jesus and the cross and communion right in the middle of justice, because this passage is an Old Testament passage, but we cannot distance Christ from the middle of justice. Okay, we find ourselves at the end of 1 Kings this morning, and it's been an amazing journey. If you were here for Andy Diamond's sermon, you had that amazing overview. So I'm just going to give you one line. We've seen two sets of kings, two sets of rebellious people, Israel in the north, Judah in the south. We've seen the theme of idolatry being played out like a broken record. We've seen the prophets then rocking up and saying, Excuse me, what do you think you're doing worshipping idols and not God? But the people are deaf. Surprise, surprise. La, 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 I'm not listening. So the prophets say, okay, over to you. Exile will come. We've seen the rise and fall of Solomon. We've hung out with Elijah and Jezebel. And we've seen the prophets of Baal brought down by a very, very wet barbecue. 1 Kings is both history and it's interpreted history. So it shouts at us all these years later, guys, wake up to the truth. Don't make the mistakes they made. Learn from them. This book is tucked away in the Old Testament. And it's still true for us today. Jesus would have known this story, okay? So we sit where Jesus would have learned. See if we can get as much out of it as he would have done. So we're going to finish 1 Kings today by looking at chapter 21 and 22, but we can't look at all of it. So I focus literally in on Naboth's vineyard because it is so important. This passage is really, really interesting. Can you just put your hand up if you're familiar with it? Okay, quite a lot over here. If you're younger than 20 and you're familiar with it, can you put your hand up? No. Okay, so we're going to look at what did it mean, and then we're going to look at what does it mean now. Tom Waits, the singer, says this, like all great things in the world, women and religion and the sky, you wonder about it and you don't stop wondering about it. So I want us to make that true about this passage. Let's keep wondering about justice and about God. This is a heavyweight passage about justice, and I presume that's relevant to all of us, right? So can you come back to this passage in your own Christian life? Don't just look at it today and then dump it. Come back to it. Because it is so much more than grapes and a sulking king and a murderous queen. On first reading, you could think it was like Macbeth, okay, without the witches and the bubbling cauldron. But it is so much more than this. So what does this passage require us to change? Because to be quite honest, if we're not willing to change anything by the end of listening to the passage, I would hesitate to say that we haven't actually listened to the passage properly. Now I've worked out, if there's 80 of you here, if we change nothing, then I've wasted 40 hours. Okay? 40 hours of irreplaceable time if you give me 30 minutes each. We have to change some things on the back of this, otherwise it's just a pointless sermon. So as I've said, it's so much more than grapes. Complementarity is the truth that something is one thing and it's also something else. So this passage is a passage about a very, very long time ago and about a man who made wine and then lost his life. But it's also, on the other hand, a story about us and our use and our misuse of power. What does this story about justice have to do with you and me? To quote Rob Bell in his book, it has everything to do with us. Let me read you what he says. How we eat is connected to how we care for the planet, which is connected to how we use our resources, which is connected to how many people in the world go to bed hungry every night, which is connected to how food is distributed, which is connected to the massive inequalities in our world between those who have and those who don't have, which is connected to how our justice system treats people who use their power to make millions of dollars while others struggle just to buy food, which is connected to how we treat those who don't have what we have, which is connected to the sanctity and holiness and mystery of human life. That's page 117 of his amazing book. Buy it, it's fantastic. We are all involved. So let's take a little look at the key players. We're going to look at Naboth, King Ahab, Jezebel, the community, which is massive, and just very briefly, Elijah. Now, Naboth was a nice guy, and he owned a small vineyard on the eastern slope of the hill of Jezreel, all right? Just down from the Sea of Galilee. There's his vineyard. And it had been in his family well for as long as he could remember, and the soil was very, very productive. It happened to be near King Ahab's home. Put yourself, will you, into Naboth's sandals. One day you're out tending your vineyard, minding your own business, flicking off bugs, pulling up weeds, a bit like what Lee and I do at our allotment, and in walks King Ahab, who makes you an offer that you can't refuse, but you do. The king wants your vineyard to plant an allotment or a herb garden, and quite a lot of scholars say that he was going to grow herbs for his Baal worship, which is interesting. Anyway, he offers you a better vineyard or whatever else you want. But this vineyard has been in your family since, well, forever. Back when God handed out the land to the 12 tribes of Israel, he forbade any of you to give it away permanently or to sell it. Check out Leviticus 25:23. It all belongs to me. It isn't your land, and you only live here for a little while. Our 21st century ideas of property, ownership, need, and rights to land must be scrutinized in the light of this passage. Just what relationship do we feel we have with our houses or our gardens or indeed our piece of land called the UK? We have no ultimate claim at all, and nor can we stipulate that others are not welcome, because we are, after all, just a passing through. So anyway, God forbade the selling of land to protect the vulnerable and to keep things fair. And selling land could cause the new owners to become enslaved the old owners to become enslaved to the new owners. To sell could literally sell yourself and your family into slavery. It is all tied up with the year of Jubilee, so I suggest we haven't got time to look at that fully, but go and Google the year of Jubilee. Whoops. So justice, equality, and community were non-negotiable parts of faith. They were not a bolt-on extra. And the Old Testament gives special attention, if you read it, to economics and exploitation of the weak. And they were obliged to do justice, not just talk about it, to protect the poor and the stranger. So get back into Naboth's sandals. It is honesty, Naboth, that stops you from selling your vineyard. Honesty. You tell the king, I'm not able to under God's law. Now, King Ahab was the king bound by the Torah, so he should have shaken your hand, congratulated you on doing the right thing, and ridden off on his proverbial donkey to find somewhere else for his cumin, cardamom, and coriander. But he doesn't. He storms off, he throws himself on his bed, and pushes his posh little nose up against the wall in a sulk. Now, naturally, Jezebel wants to know what's going on. Why are you not eating your tea? Now, we've met her before, right? You remember, with prophets of Baal and Asherah, she killed as many of Yahweh's prophets as she could get her grubby little hands on. But she did ultimately lose, if you remember, on Mount Carmel. She was some fierce lady, but I'm not sure we'd probably call her a lady. She was a Phoenician princess, and she was not going to give up her gods like Ruth did. And her husband, in 1 Kings 16, 31 to 33, very happy to go along with it all. So she asks Ahab what the fuss is about. And if you remember in the passage Andy read, Ahab whines, he wouldn't give it to me. But conveniently, he doesn't tell Jezebel why you, Naboth, could not sell it. So as we know, Jezebel takes into her own hands. She treats Ahab like the little boy that he has become. Stop sniveling. Aren't you the king? I'll get it for you. You have rights simply because you are the king and you are the owner of the land and you rule over it. Does he? Just because he's in a position of power, does he have special rights? Not under God's system, he doesn't. Okay? Not under God's system, he doesn't. God's provision throughout the whole of history and the Old and New Testament is slewed towards the poor and the vulnerable. So what are the monarchy then, past and present? Now, in the past, kings and queens and rulers have taken land, treasure, art, let alone people, which were not theirs to take. I don't know if you've followed the news this week, but there's a story of the bronze statue of a cockerel from Jesus College, Cambridge, that has been taken down now and is going to be sent back to where it was stolen from in Nigeria, I think, many years ago by the people in power in the UK. That was just a tiny example of power being misused historically. Now, rulers and royals have suppressed historically. They've conquered and abused. Check out the history books if you need any convincing. Oh, yes, but that was then. This is now. We are a civilized nation, and we have a royal family who doesn't have any real power. Forgive me for drawing our attention to a few awkward facts, but as the Lutheran pastor, Nadia Boltz-Weber, says, church must be a place where we walk into difficult truths. Church must be a place where we walk into difficult truths, not opinions, truths. What I'm about to say is fact, however we want to dress it up. I'm not sure how I feel about one family having subject to different laws to us, not paying the same taxes as us, being able to veto laws that adversely affect them, and having jurisdiction over 360,000 acres of land. I'm not sure that is just. The land is not, no land is ours, but nor does it belong to governments, nor any royal family. Large parts of Cornwall may belong to the Duchy of Cornwall due to a decision in 1337, but what about the principle of the Year of Jubilee, and what about fairness? As uncomfortable as that may be for us. So, back to Jezebel. You know from the story, she forges Ahab's signature, she stamps his seal, and she sends a letter to your officials, Naboth, in your town, telling them to call everyone to a meeting to fast and pray. That's a bit like Tony and the elders calling us all together to fast and pray because we've offended God, and we would come with the expectation that they're going to help us sort this out. They would have come to this expecting the leaders to sort out what they've done to offend God. But two false witnesses are paid to swear that you, Naboth, curse God and the king. Jezebel conveniently knew, didn't she, and thus is like law, to know what happened to blasphemers. Look up Leviticus 24:14-16. So she told them to lynch you, drag you out, and stone you to death. She was a nice lady. The writers of Kings use a clever device. Look at chapter 21, verse 9, because the writer uses a letter. So it gives away what is planned for Naboth, and we're really curious to see if the community are going to stand up and say, stop, enough, how dare you, this guy's a righteous man of God, or if they go along with it and pick up their rocks. Yep. The community go along with it. She asks the leaders to jump and they say, how high? Or she says, throw stones, and they say, how many? Your community voluntarily follows a corrupt royal instruction to commit a major crime against you, Naboth, your family, against the community itself, and against God. They are clearly used to doing what the house of Ahab said without thinking. Without thinking is the key. What about us? Do we roll over for our leaders with no thought? I love that picture. Do we roll over for the powers in our land and exploit and corrupt ourselves? Do we speak up against fracking, corruption, illegal tax havens, bankrolling of the political parties? That's to just name a few. Go and trawl the newspapers, you'll find more. Or do we leave it to people like Russell Brand, who has the guts, actually, to speak up against racist newspapers, elitist and sexist workplace practices, sweatshops, where the majority are 80% women, and climate change, to name but four? And I recommend that you watch the truths. You may not like the way he presents himself. You may not like some of his language, but he speaks up against injustice and he speaks up for the poor. I've just gone one too fast, ignore that. He speaks up for the poor. Go to Proverbs 31:8-9. We're going to read this later, but that is what he's speaking up for, those without a voice. So I suggest you pray for Russell Brand. Don't sit in judgment. Tony said last week about secular wisdom, okay? All through Scripture, prophets were deemed odd, and they were rejected because of how they looked and because of what they said. I'm not saying he's a prophet, but he has a prophetic voice about justice. We need to get involved in the debate. Now, unlike Brand, we agree to atrocities by our silence. Let's not pretend otherwise. And this is Bonhoeffer. He says this: silence in the face of evil is in itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak, and not to act is to act. Surely, people in the future won't look back at us, will they, and wonder why we didn't speak up more or do more to end world's poverty and hunger? Have a guess, how many people in the UK are overweight or obese, percentage-wise? Someone, shout out. How many do you think, by health stats, are overweight or obese in the UK? 61.7, three times what it was in 1980. But at the same time, 780 million go to bed hungry. What will people in the future make of that? And in fact, what will people in the future make of us? It's a harsh statistic, but it has to be said. So Naboth's community partners with Jezebel to exploit and corrupt itself. They partner with corrupt authority, and by doing so, God says, they corrupt themselves. The blame is not just laid at the leaders. It's not a case of evil Ahab and vile Jezebel. And I like the fact that evil and vile are the same letters, but you can swing them out. That's not what it's about. Don't we like that? Don't we like saying, oh, typical Tory government, a ridiculous Labour council, oh, bureaucratic Brussels? Don't we do it? I do it. Blame is not laid just on the leaders. It's laid on the whole community. Not standing up against shameful acts paralyses our communities, societies, our countries and our world because we become partners. Now, in a country where governments, rulers and dictators have unbridled power, what happens? Well, justice is the casualty. Justice unravels when we lose sight of who we are in God's sight. And it's very hard to put back again. I just want to say thank God for Mike Askew, who went over, wait for this, with an organisation who's partnering, in the right sense, in Ethiopia, with Justice for All. They had direct access to 170 leaders, including judges, to tackle corruption at the national level. Pray for Mike. Get involved in the Appointment Institute. It's the most brilliant thing. Because when justice unravels, you try putting that ball of wool back together. So pray for people like Mike. Get involved. And in Naboth's time, corruption had permeated every level of society. Question for you. In what ways do we go along with institutional corruption and allow the poor to be left poor with all the misery and the suffering that means? Let's not pretend any otherwise. If you're poor, you live and die in poverty, in suffering often. We look on in horror, don't we? They are manipulated so easily by Jezebel. She says, throw a rock, and they say, how many? But literally, they don't question her authority, but are we any different? We allow newspapers and medias to manipulate our opinion against the poor, against migrants, I hate that word, but I'm just putting it there, that's how they're called, and unemployed, don't we? The poor. We conclude the following, we cannot do more. We are doing enough. They deserve it anyway. Things happen for a reason, and so poverty is just their lot. As a country, we are being taken for granted and are at breaking point. Peter Singer, Debs will love him, he's Australian. In his brilliant book, The Life You Can Save, looks at this whole issue and explores the reasons that we don't do more for the poor, and it changed my life. I cannot recommend it highly enough. I just want to highlight five reasons he gives for why we don't do more for the poor. He's not a Christian. He pushes way beyond what we're doing. So I'm just going to give you the five. Poor individuals in other countries are out of sight, therefore out of mind. Sound familiar? Definitely. Two, we know that a billion people share the responsibility for saving the 10 million children who die every year from poverty. We know we share the responsibility, but because we know we share it, we do less than if it was just down to me. It's a known fact. Often, therefore, we give nothing at all. To illustrate this, he says this, if I'm walking past a pond and there's a child drowning, I'm on my own, I do not hesitate, I go in. If I'm walking along with Anna, and I don't know who Anna is, two of us, there's a hesitation. Is she going or am I going to go? So there's a hesitation. 40 people go past who don't know each other. What happens? They all assume someone else is doing it. And they fail to act because there are too many people assuming everyone else is doing it. Collective responsibility. The third thing he says is we are less willing to give if we feel we're already giving more than other people because it's just not fair. It isn't. Life isn't fair. The fourth is we are less likely to give if it's just money being asked for. Now notice, we asked for harmonicas, money for harmonicas. You guys were so overwhelmingly generous. When asked for money, we often tend to start questioning the ethics of the country, the corruption of the leaders, and whether the money will anyway get through. So we do nothing. And the fifth is we feel it's a drop in the ocean. We focus on the millions we can't help rather than the one or two we can. These five reasons then become what? They become excuses. Tom Wright, the theologian, tweeted recently, shallow thinking and shallow loving often keep company. Shallow thinking and shallow loving often keep company. The whole community stoned Naboth to death. And rather than lessen the guilt, it actually spreads it. If we're silent, we're guilty too. Look, there's my name on the stone. We all have stones of injustice which we throw. Naboth's whole family is stoned to death with him. Check out 2 Kings 9:26. Conveniently leaving his vineyard without an heir. Wonderful. Naboth's land reverts to the king because he's found guilty of treason and blasphemy, even if it's false. So Naboth, lying in a pit, bloody and dead, with rocks on his head. Well, what's the king supposed to do? When he'd whined to Jezebel, he signs his death certificate, make no mistake. It isn't really a very nice story, but then Ahab and Jezebel weren't really very nice people. And God quickly sent Elijah to Naboth's vineyard, as Andy read, to give Ahab a very serious message. Here you have it. You have made me very angry. You have caused Israel to commit sin. Ashamed and frightened, he humbles himself. And for once, Jezebel doesn't speak. There is always collective blame and responsibility with sin in kings. Wherever the king sins, the people suffer. Injustice in kings is portrayed like this, and particularly in Naboth's story. Disordering of relationships, breakdown between the people and the land, between the king and the people, between the community and the people, between the people and God, and between people and people. This is so much more than grapes. Today there are plenty of dispossessed Naboths and Ahab tyrants. Peter Marshall says this: we are too Christian really to enjoy sinning, and too fond of sinning really to enjoy Christianity. Most of us know perfectly well what we ought to do. Our trouble is that we do not want to do it. And Einstein said this: if you have the privilege to know, you have the duty to act. So we need to ask probing questions so that we're not joining in with injustices. Let me ask you some of these. Who made this white T-shirt, and how much did the person who made it get paid? Was a child involved? I don't know. I need to find out. Who made this tea? What pesticides were used, and what health issues are caused by that person? What wage do they get? I don't know. Who really pays for cheap flights, and what's the environmental impact on the world and therefore on the world's poor? Because the world's poor get screwed first. I don't know. What's the carbon footprint of my own life? I don't know. I bank. What's the ethics of my bank, and where do they invest? I don't know. Fair trade gold, fair trade diamonds. What unethical practices go into if it's not fair trade? I didn't even know fair trade gold existed till last week. Shame on me. What happens to the environment with pesticides that we happily use in agriculture, and what happens to packaging we throw away? You could ask another 100 questions. We need to probe so we're not part of the injustices, because ignorance is no excuse. I want to highlight just one of those probing questions with this wonderful story of hope. Some of you know her. She's called Charlotte Instone. She's 23. She's a Christian. She's just launched this company called Know the Origin. It's a star-led ethical brand that reconnects us with people and processes behind the clothing. I interviewed her about her faith. She said this: I began thinking about creating justice with the passions and gifts I have been given. I met Rana Plaza survivors, and I've worked in Syrian refugee camps. Some of the best generosity ever. Every decision we make affects someone on the other side of the world. Start changing our lifestyle, because from everyone who's been given much, much will be expected. We have more power than we think. When we do not use our voices, we let things carry on as they are. It's not okay for people to go to work and die making our clothes. It's not okay for cotton farmers to live terribly so they can get the lowest price to fill our wardrobes, thus to simply throw it away later on in the season. It's not okay for women to work in factories where they're trafficked or sexually assaulted in the process of making our cheap clothes. The earth is at breaking point. The last 60 years have seen massive shifts in land, nitrogen pollution, and climate change. A shirt takes 2,700 litres of water to make. You have to know what's going on. It's not just about boycotting shops like Primark. It's about questioning. If you're buying a £5 pair of jeans, what wages have those people been paid to make it possible? Get involved at fashionrevolution.org. So what can we do to restore areas of justice? How can we obey Mark 12, 30 to 31, which says love God first and your neighbour as yourself? While the world's poorest people may not arrive on our doorsteps to confront us, yet, The wildlife pushed to extinction may not come and camp out in our gardens, and the climate may not send a tornado and flood DHA-6, but Naboth's murder screams out at us from the past for justice, and it shouts, enough. Something has to be done on a global scale. Misuse and abuse of land and the planet is directly affecting the world's poorest people. We cannot do everything, but we can do something. We can do something, not nothing. And at times, it will seem like something and nothing because of the scale of injustice in God's world. Remember, as we come to a close, sin takes us further than we want to go, keeps us longer than we want to stay, and costs us more than we want to pay. Just ask Ahab about that. So let's commit to living Proverbs 31, not just talking about it. Let's humble ourselves and mean these words. Can we say these together, please? I've added the "we must" in the brackets. We must speak up for the people who have no voice, for the rights of the down and outers. We must speak out for justice and stand up for the poor and destitute. Thank God this passage is much more than grace, because we have no excuse.